This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.
Chapter 45. Special Agent Joseph Merritt, the FBI's designated negotiator, walked toward the man in his underwear and the orange electrical cord around his neck, standing in the middle of the bridge. DHS and his district supervisor had given him specific instructions on what to tell Roberts. He was not to contradict Roberts' claim that he was somehow infected, and he could promise him anything within reason if it could get him clear of the bridge and the noose. At the outer edge of the perimeter, an FBI SWAT team watched as the negotiator approached Mitchell Roberts. They had been informed by DHS that it was likely a chemical agent that Mitchell had been using. When it was obvious that he wasn't concealing anything on his body that fit the profile, Commander gave the order for them to use gas masks instead of the more cumbersome, tactical, nuclear, biological, chemical suits that they had in the truck. Mitch held up his hand for the agent to stop when he was 15 feet away. Mitch could make out the man's face through the glass on the helmet. He had a broad grin and thinning red hair. "Hello, Mitchell," said the agent. He used the informality as a way to put Mitchell at ease. "I'm not used to talking to people with a spacesuit on. Feel like I should be asking you to take me to your leader." Mitch stared at the man for a moment. He was about to ask if corny jokes were a tactic to wear him down, but thought better of it. "I'm not used to negotiating in my underwear." Mitchell paused. "Begging, yes." Agent Merritt smiled. Through his earpiece, he could hear one of the people listening on the microphone let out a muffled laugh. "My name is Special Agent Joseph Merritt. You can call me Joe. My job is to negotiate with you and listen to your demands. I'm empowered to make anything happen that we think is reasonable."
Wait a second, interrupted Mitch.
"Demands? Demands are what bank robbers and terrorists have. I don't want anything. I just want to know that if I surrender, I won't be torn to pieces, and that I'll be safe from whoever is responsible for this." "Who do you think did this to you, Mitchell? I'd like to help." The question was posed with the calm sincerity of a parent talking to a child about monsters. It took every bit of Mitchell's will not to react sarcastically or get angry. Acting defensively in either way could make him look paranoid and unbalanced. "Look, Joe, I don't know what's happening to me. I hear all the crazy things that people say on the radio. I see firsthand what happens when people come near me." Mitch looked down at his body. "Look at me, man. This is real. Those bite marks, those scratches, they happened. I want an explanation for this." Mitch looked at the crowd of the law enforcement officials on either side. "We need answers for all the people who got hurt. Let me help you get some answers. What do you need?"
"I need to know that anyone who comes near me is going to be wearing proper protective equipment."
"Protective of what?" asked Merritt.
Mitchell blinked.
The question came out sounding like a probe.
"Protective of me! My scent! Maybe I've got some rage virus, like they said."
"Who said?"
"Talk show hosts! People on the radio, filling airtime! I don't know who. Man, it's just one of those things that comes up when people are looking for an explanation."
"What else do you need?" asked Merritt.
"I need to know that you have a safe way to transport me from here."
"A vehicle to keep you from getting attacked."
"Yes," said Mitchell.
Merritt held up a finger as he was getting instructions through an earpiece. He looked at Mitch and nodded.
"That's not going to be a problem."
"Okay.
We're going to transport you in an armored truck. That way nobody can get at you and hurt you. Does that sound good?"
Mitch shook his head.
"No, it does not. Ask the people on the other end of your radio how an armored truck is supposed to keep people from smelling me and getting wind of whatever makes them attack."
Merritt held up his fingers again as he got more instructions.
"They're designed to withstand tear gas attacks and are sealed tight."
Mitchell felt the hair raise on the back of his neck.
He realized that it wasn't just the negotiator acting in a patronizing way. The people he was dealing with really didn't think there was anything wrong with them. They had bought into some other theory about a weapon. Mitchell had to call their bluff. He leaned back on the railing and looked over the edge of the bridge for the moment.
"Joe, Special Agent Merritt," said Mitch,
"I'm sure the people you're talking to will promise me the world if you think that it'll get me away from the edge of the bridge, get this stupid thing off my neck while 1,000 cameras are on us. The one thing I am asking for right now is the truth. An armored truck is designed to keep things on the outside from getting in, like people and tear gas. Air may be filtered on its way in, but not on its way out. Either the people you are talking to know that and are just trying to bullshit me because they're under some false pretense that I'm up to something, or they're incompetent and can't be trusted with my life." Mitch waved his arm at the buildings and pointed at the Channel 8 camera. "Or the lives of everyone else around me. A truck that's not airtight is a menace to everyone we drive past."
"Mitchell, we're being totally straight with you," Merritt said in his most sincere voice.
"You want to believe I'm acting under some kind of delusion or have some kind of sinister plan for the sake of everybody, have the courtesy to treat my delusion with some kind of consistency."
Agent Merritt listened to instructions. He nodded.
"All right, Mitchell. Here's the deal. Got a lot of people scared right now. Traffic is shut down on highways. People are afraid to go into public spaces. There's a lot of families upset with you. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I've met a lot of different personality types. Had you figured out the moment I saw you standing here with that silly cord around your neck. If you were serious, you'd have a gun to your head. You'd be up someplace high. You're just a guy that wants attention to pretend he's a victim in all this. Obviously, it's not on you. But we'll find it, though."
"What?"
asked Mitchell. Merritt reached down and turned off a knob at his waist. The suit began to deflate as the pressurized air coming from his backpack came to a stop. He reached to undo a seal under his helmet.
Please stop! Please stop!" shouted Mitchell.
"You can stop this at any time, Mitchell. Tell us where we can find the other canisters."
Mitchell heard a hiss as the latch opened. He looked at the rows of people on either side of the bridge.
"For God's sake, somebody stop him!" he shouted. He looked up at the Channel 8 building, his eyes filled with desperation. Merritt tossed the helmet aside and opened his arms.
"Don't feel like jumping, do you, Mitch?"
Merritt took in a large nose full of air. Mitchell backed towards the railing. He could feel the metal against his back.
"I'm not gonna miss that."
Merritt's voice turned into a snarl as he bared his teeth and ran toward Mitchell with his fingers curled into claws. Vulnerable, naked, with nothing to use to defend himself, Mitchell held his hands in front of his face and knelt down. As Merritt closed in on him, Mitchell grabbed him by the legs and picked him up into the air. Mitchell threw his body to the left as hard as he could. Mitchell fell on his side. The air tank on his back slowed him down as he tried to get up. He rolled over and came at Mitchell in a four-legged crawl. Mitch's foot hit the helmet on the ground. He picked it up and swung it at Merritt's head so hard, the glass cracked. Blood drops splattered from his broken nose. SWAT team got orders and their earpieces to take Mitchell down. They swarmed past their barrier with their guns drawn. The 0.3 micron filters on their gas masks proved no stopgap for the air around Mitchell. Once they passed the barrier Mitch had set up, their posture began to change. Millions of people watched on television. Cops with gas masks turned from highly disciplined law enforcement officers into a pack of rabid dogs. Several of them dropped their guns as they clawed out in the air and they ran toward Mitch. Two of them reflexively pulled their triggers, sending a wild barrage of gunfire that ricocheted off the bridge and hit nearby buildings and the vehicles on the other side. Channel 8 cameras zoomed into the terror in Mitch's eyes as they came at him, ready to rip out his throat and tear him to pieces in a violent slaughter. The world watched as Mad Mitch pulled the noose tight over his neck and jumped over the edge of the bridge. Chapter 46. Driven by rage,
The SWAT team members leaped over the edge after him in their full armored gear, not to save him, but to kill him. The cord around Mitchell's neck snapped and he fell into the water. Black armored SWAT team members rained down as they hit the water. Another wave of law enforcement officers swarmed onto the bridge. 20 more people were overcome by rage and leaped into the water. Bystanders were paralyzed with panic as they realized that whatever reflex it was that made people go mad overpowered every other instinct. Men thrashed in the water and began to drown as they bared their teeth and clawed out furiously, trying to kill anything they couldn't see. As the presence of Mitchell subsided, rescuers were eventually able to reach the thrashing men and pull them to shore. EMTs and police officers worked quickly to resuscitate those that had drowned. News anchors tried to make sense of what happened for their viewers while they watched it unfold. Expert pundits began to doubt what they had been told. What should have been a very simple surrender was botched in the worst possible way. The FBI director barked some orders to his subordinates, then turned to his DHS counterpart. "What the hell is going on?" The other man shrugged. The FBI district director answered his ringing BlackBerry. "Yes, sir. I understand, sir." The deputy director of the FBI was on the other end of the line and was furious with what he'd seen on the news. "Well, we were acting under information that this was caused by a weapon of some kind." "No, sir. I believe that information is incorrect." He looked over to the DHS director. "I think we proceed under the assumption that this is a public health crisis and not primarily a criminal investigation." "Yes, sir." He hung up and started giving orders. The DHS director's phone was ringing too. He looked at the FBI district director. "We're asking the Center for Disease Control to step in and provide assistance. We're going with the patient zero hypothesis." From his vantage point, the FBI district director had clearly seen his negotiator break down and attack Mitchell, an attack that he was sure had gone out live to millions of viewers. The response of his SWAT team confirmed, in his mind, that absent any kind of dispersant on the bridge or some other weapon, the most likely hypothesis was the one that Mitchell had been telling everyone all along. "Where the fuck was that weasel Baylor?" he asked. Baylor watched the disaster on his hotel room television. The moment he saw that Mitchell had stripped down to his underwear, he knew the current plan wasn't going to work. If the canister wasn't found on his person, then the allegations of it being planted were going to be too loud. He had half a mind to text Mr. Lewis and ask him to go in after the drowning man and throw the canister in the water to be discovered. The problem at that point would be that what they found in the canister wouldn't be found in the men's lungs. The FBI was going to want to do their own tests on the blood and tissue matched to the material in the canister. It would be apparent to them that whatever caused the reaction wasn't the same as what was in the spray can. He needed to figure out a strategy for the patient zero hypothesis that could minimize blowback and protect Great Wall. He called Mr. Lewis to give him instructions on how to proceed. After rescuers had pulled all the law enforcement personnel from the water, the search continued for Mitchell Roberts. Rescue divers searched the bottom of the waterway in a spiral pattern moving outwards along the bay and intracoastal. The outgoing tide gave them a half-mile radius to search, and that was growing by a mile every hour. City and county police were sent to watch along the waterfront to see if he climbed ashore anywhere. Marine patrol and Coast Guard boats were brought in to canvass the area, while helicopters from four different agencies swept the area around the bridge and surrounding city, looking for any signs of Mitchell. Chapter 47. Naked and exhausted, Mad Mitch climbed onto the dive platform of the newly christened Monkey's Paw. 2 miles away, he could hear the helicopters as they buzzed around the South Bay Bridge and the manhunt continued. He had very little time until the search extended outwards and law enforcement started stopping vessels in the water near him. The necessity of an escape plan came to Mitch after he listened to the paranoid Dr. Lovestrange on Rookman's show. Up until the FBI negotiator had tried to patronizingly convince him that an armored car was going to serve as an airtight transport, he was fully committed to the idea that they believed him, or at the very least were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. The attack on the bridge proved otherwise. Mitchell had been lied to. He still wasn't sure if it was out of incompetence or the machinations of someone trying to cover up something. The effect was the same. Mitchell couldn't trust anyone. The idea for the escape came to him when he was looking for a boat to steal. Originally, he thought of taking a bigger yacht in the event that he got stuck in a prolonged standoff. What attracted him to the Donzi was the piece of equipment that had just saved his life. The SBS 730 was an underwater propulsion device used by very rich scuba divers, the military, and drug smugglers. Shaped like a cross between a torpedo and a jet ski, it could go up to 8 miles an hour underwater and had over 20-mile range. What made the SBS 730 unique was that it had its own sonar system, making it possible to navigate in limited visibility of the waterway and the intracoastal. The unit cost half as much as the boat Mitch had stolen to get it. Before Mitch tied the John boat to the shore by the bridge, he found the exact middle and dropped the SBS 730 overboard, tied to a weighted-down duffel bag filled with dive gear. When he had no other option except to jump, he made sure to land on top of his underwater stash. He hit the water, and after a few milliseconds of panicked freefall, when he wasn't sure if the extension cord was going to break like it was supposed to, he hit the water, swam straight down 10 feet to the muck-covered floor below. It took him a frantic minute before his hands found the propulsion unit and his duffel bag with the compressed air tank. He hadn't gone scuba diving in years, but his instincts kicked in and he remembered how to clear the mask and strap the tank on underwater. He ignored the sounds of bodies hitting the surface overhead and focused on getting away as fast as he could. Somewhere in the 2 miles between the South Bay Bridge and the powerboat, he lost his underwear and turbulence as the propulsion unit carried him through the water, adding just one more indignity to his plan. To get back to the boat while underwater, he relied on the sonar and compass as he looked for the mooring lines of the boats. He remembered passing on the way in. Finally, he reached the Monkey's Paw and surfaced near the dive platform. Before he struggled to pull the SBS 730 on board, he ran to a dive locker and found a diving suit to wear. Looking down at the skin-tight suit, he wished he would have worn that instead of his underwear when he'd tried to surrender on national television. Although, he had narrowly escaped that time. Mitchell was sure they'd cast a tighter net next time. He had to make sure that when he surrendered, it was to the right people. He started up the boat and had to decide which way to take it. He had 3 options. Going further up the intracoastal and away from South Florida meant traveling through less populated areas. The advantage was that it was away from where he'd been. The disadvantage was that there were less side canals and avenues to escape. He could take an exit that led straight out to sea and follow the shoreline north or south. That would put him well within the Coast Guard's crosshairs and only give him a beach as an escape. His other option was to head back south. There were numerous canals and natural harbors where he could blend in and take the boat ashore if he decided to abandon it. Felt like backtracking, but backtracking from what? He'd never had a final destination. Heading to a more popular area might give him more options for surrendering. He felt safer knowing that millions of people would be watching from news helicopters. He also had to deal with a limited amount of fuel. If he ran out, rather take his chances stealing another boat than getting stranded nowhere near another escape route. There was also the idea that they wouldn't expect him to go south since all of his travels had been to the north. Mitchell pulled up anchor and pointed the boat toward the south. He sat back in the cockpit chair and tried to look like just another boater out for an afternoon trip. 15 miles away, Mr. Lewis was planning his own afternoon trip. He'd received new instructions from Baylor, and it took him a half hour to arrange it. Fortunately, he had a number of associates in South Florida that could facilitate what he needed. When he pulled into the hangar near the small private airport near the Everglades, his associate, Mr. Travis, was finishing marking up the tail letters of the helicopter. He pointed out a long case to Mr. Lewis. He walked over to the table, covered in tools, and opened the case. Inside was a sniper's rifle with a high magnification scope.
It's gonna be a bitch to shoot from the air if he's on the water, said Mr. Travis.
Current plan is to have you drive me near the overpass so I can shoot from the ground as he passes by. If that doesn't work, we have other options.
Mr. Travis stepped back to look at the new lettering on the tail.
If they run it, they'll know it's bogus.
I'm not worried about that right now. Every bird in South Florida is going to be out looking for him. I just want a plausible denial about where the chopper came from, replied Mr. Lewis.
Good thing. I like my job here.
Never get too attached, said Mr. Lewis, as he looked through the rifle scope and aimed it at a fuel tank across the tarmac and dry-fired.
Mr. Lewis was already suspicious that Mitchell had been using the waterways to get around. When Mitchell vanished after the dive, he informed Baylor of that. Baylor was about to tell the FBI that was where they should be directing their search efforts when he realized that he had an opportunity. When it was clear that Mitchell's body wasn't going to be found, Baylor called Mr. Lewis with a new plan. If Mitchell was shot out of sight, it would point to an accomplice who wanted to keep him silent. Baylor didn't care if Mitchell talked. He didn't have anything to say. The real advantage to his death was that it would appear that he knew something worth getting killed for. Or, if one of Baylor's associates could get access to Mitchell's body before any of the other agencies, he could misdirect them as need be.
This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.